You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 5th to the 11th of December 2013. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Jack Grove and David Matthews and books editor Karen Shook. The lack of female representation in universities has again been highlighted by a study that shows just a third of governors are women. We'll hear more about that in just a moment. Karen will bring us some of the highlights from this week's books section after that. Most of the UK's universities allow gender segregation at campus events, provided it isn't forced, THE researchers found. That's David's story. We'll hear a bit more about that later in the show. And our cover feature this week looks at Turkey, where the state is confronting student protests with an iron fist. But first, our lead news story. Jack, this is you. Female representation among university governors. What's the picture?
Well, this is a new study today published by Women Count, which is done an audit of all the governing bodies of UK universities, and they've done similar things for FTSE 100 companies and charities, and they've found that there's quite an absence of women on these boards. Only about a third of governors are women, and this basically just feeds into a conversation and a feeling that there's not enough women at the top of universities. They don't have enough power. And I think the important thing about this story is that governing bodies are the ones that select the institution's vice chancellor. So there has been a feeling that these bodies are selecting in their own image. So if you don't have very many women on those boards, they're very unlikely to select a woman, and they just sort of select, and it's sort of self-perpetuating. So there's some devolved nations like Scotland and Wales that are going to insist on quotas, but there's nothing really going on in the UK to really address this. And I think it's quite a significant barrier maybe to diversifying the power balance in UK universities.
Yeah, it's not the first time we've had stories on gender imbalance in universities. It's a bit like a stuck record in the THE to an extent. I mean, you author the article that covers our gender index as well, which is always interesting reading. Yeah. Do you think there should be targets? I mean, I know sort of in terms of boards on companies, there's a lot of targeting, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a sort of real desire to get the balance there more equal. Do we need that in academia?
Well, yes, I think that's quite a good idea, actually. It's been something that has been suggested for FTSE 100 companies, where having more women would be seen as a more moderating aspect on some of the macho, very risk-taking culture that existed in the city and led to some of the problems that we maybe saw over the last few years. So this has been suggested as a way of combating that. So I'm sure it could work in universities.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's, it should be said, we name and shame, and indeed name and praise, the institutions with the most gender balanced boards and those with the least gender balanced boards in the article on page 6 and 7 this week. I won't reveal them now. Go online, timeshighereducation.co.uk, or pick out your copy and have a look at that. Moving on, the book section this week, Karen, let's hear a little bit more about what we can find in there.
We've got a bumper book section this week. You'll be pleased to hear if you were worried that there has been a crisis since 2007, you need to consult a philosophical anthropologist named Janet Reutemann. Our reviewer Chris Knight takes on her view that really it's a question of syntax and grammar. There isn't necessarily a crisis, and we should just think about what we're calling it and whether it was there at all. Mm. Chris Knight gives that short shrift. Claire Brandt from King's College London reviews Vic Gatrell's book, The First Bohemians, Life and Art in London's Golden Age. And if you think any of your colleagues are a bit dishevelled, think of George Daw, a member of the Royal Academy, who was known as the Grub. He washed only the oval of his face, leaving a black frame of grime that attracted wonder even in his own day as he sauntered down Longacre. We've also got The Pleasure's All Mine, A History of Perverse Sex, all in the best academic taste, of course, reviewed by Alison Oram. The book is by Julie Peekman. It considers things such as onanism, sadomasochism, necrophilia and incest, and the moral issues about sexual activity with animals. We may find it repellent, but in what circumstances is it immoral? You can read about that in our review. Also, Chris Jones from the University of St. Andrews reviews Alexander McCall Smith's quite touching book, What W.H. Auden Can Do For You. I'm not sure that W.H. Auden taught him how to sell millions of copies of books, but according to Chris Jones, he certainly did show that poetry should not belong only to those who study it as part of their discipline.
Well, since he's written two series of very high, well-selling books, hasn't he? Is he the female detective agency?
That's that right, yes. Yeah. Yes. We're not sure how Auden filters into that, but he's definitely a big fan. And our book of the week is by David Runciman of the University of Cambridge. Bill Perdue reviews his book, The Confidence Trap. This grows out of a number of lectures that Runciman has given on this subject. He talks about Francis Fukuyama's End of History and says that, in fact, it's not, if we're worried about democracy, it's not because Fukuyama was wrong that there's an end of history, but in fact that he was right on some of the points about liberal democracy. And Runciman's thesis is that democracy has always been adaptable, can't get things done quite as quickly as your average despot, but it does muddle through and it's adaptable. However, our reviewer suggests that some of Runciman's theses overlook the fact that many of the crises he discusses in 20th century history may not have been primarily tests of political systems, but they may have had a lot to do with economics as well. It's a book that's attracted a lot of attention, and also the thesis, he is academic royalty in a sense. His father and his mother, Dame Ruth Runciman and Jerry Runciman, respectively, highly involved in social policy and in sociology.
Now, a bumper week for books, also a bumper week for podcasts, I should point out. I spoke actually about the uncertain future of many of the US's community colleges with J. Noah Brown, who is chief executive of the Association of Community College Trustees. We've got an interview podcast with him available, probably where you found this podcast. It's in the same place. And there's also a dedicated university rankings podcast available, which follows the launch of our BRICS and Emerging Economies rankings this week. So do make sure you check those out as well. David, over to you. Page 9 this week carries your article about gender segregation at university events. What's the background to this story and what has your research revealed?
Well, on the 22nd of November, Universities UK released some guidance on how to deal with external speakers in universities. Now, this is basically in response to reports of gender segregation at events often hosted by Islamic societies, universities, and also the more general question of things like a no platform policy for the BNP or religious extremists speaking universities. Anyway, it was a long document and they gave lots of quite hedging legal advice on various things. But one of the things that attracted a lot of criticism in the national press and on the web was their guidance on gender segregation. So they basically suggested that you might achieve a, in quotes, balance of interests at these kind of events if you have one section for which was segregated by gender and one section which wasn't segregated by gender. And they also warned that you might unlawfully curtail the freedom of speech of a speaker who wants to segregate their audience if you don't allow them to speak to a segregated audience. Mm-hmm. So what we've done, we asked higher education institutions, basically, do you allow gender segregation at events on your campus? And 46 responded. And at 29 responses, there was no such prohibition on gender segregation at universities. In fact, 23 basically said they just didn't have a policy. A lot said it had never come up at their university. Now, nine universities said they just didn't permit it, full stop, and then a further 8 said they only didn't permit forced segregation. Or compulsory segregation, where you basically got, you know, the women have to sit somewhere or directed somewhere and the men have to sit somewhere else. I think, you know, actually forced gender segregation is obviously appalling and unacceptable, but UCL's policy, which only prohibits that, kind of raises this question as well. If you have a room and it's not gender segregated at all and you know, five women come in and they all choose to sit together, and all of everyone chooses to sit in the same place. Well, what can you do? Can you move them around to try and mix it up? I mean, it's then it becomes a little bit more tricky for universities, basically. I mean, it's a really interesting issue, and I think UK have perhaps rightly been pretty lambasted over it. I mean, their point is that this guidance that they put out was a legal guidance. That's what they've been stressing to us, is, you know, it was about how do universities legally steer their way through this issue. I suppose you can sort of run with that a bit, but I don't know how you can produce this kind of document without also looking morally at the issue of gender segregation and coming down clearly, is it right, is it wrong?
I looked at the guidance a bit. It looked like it was written by a team of lawyers, actually. There were so many caveats. Yeah, it was exactly. So carefully worded.
Exactly. There's a silver lining to every thorny issue.
Yeah, well, quite. But it did read like they didn't, you know, they knew that this was something that perhaps they couldn't advise on without getting themselves into a spot of bother. And the whole thing, I thought, read just a bit too... a little bit too thought out, and maybe designed by committee.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I suppose, again, to defend the UK, they emphasise it's not their policy to decide on whether on universities' policy on gender segregation. Universities are autonomous. So I don't know, is it going beyond their remit to say, you know, gender segregation is never okay in any circumstances, and all universities should ban it forthwith?
Yeah. Well, I think I'm against gender segregation, but I think if you are going to segregate, maybe you should have the women at the front and the men at the back, and sort of maybe reverse that.
I don't know, but that might be illegal, I suspect.
I wonder what they would have done in earlier, if they'd be offering helpful guidance on what to do if you had speakers who wanted Jews in a different part of the room,
exactly.
Or blacks, or gay people.
Yeah.
It seems that this is probably the only situation when we're talking about gross discrimination and someone's helpfully issuing guidance on it. I don't think they would feel comfortable doing it in any other way. The issue about genuinely held religious belief, I mean, clearly this is about coercion. And it seems a bit weaselly to me that they're saying, well, it won't be forced, but of course you're not going to be the only woman attending a religious speakers event and go sit with others.
Yeah, it doesn't sit comfortably with me to respect the rights of someone who insists on segregating people as well, and that being the reason for this challenge.
You could have a genuinely
challenge.
Held belief that you really want blacks at the back of the room.
Exactly. Anyway, we must move on. Jack, actually, you also have the cover feature this week. You visited Turkey earlier this year, a country where the government appears to be taking on the educated classes. What did you find out while you were out there? And very quickly, we're actually running a little bit over. Just give us a flavour of what your feature is about.
Well, it's all about how the how students and staff in the universities are coming up against a very authoritarian government under the leadership of Erdogan. And when I was in Turkey, there was big student riots in the middle of Istanbul. I was tear gassed myself. I saw lots of students hurling rocks and creating big barricades in the middle of the street. So it's quite interesting stuff to see firsthand, and it's been rumbling on for many months, and I think it will go on for a lot longer. But at the same time, there's a big reform agenda as well, where they're trying to make universities more autonomous and give them more freedom to innovate. And I'm just looking at the clash between those two things that are happening in Turkish universities.
No, interesting stuff. Do check that out. Well, thanks for listening to this issue review. As I mentioned, there are two other podcasts out this week as well that you can check out on the podcast page of timeshighereducation.co.uk, and of course on iTunes. But that's all for this week's Times Higher Education issue review.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.